10 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. From the World Service of the BBC, this is News Desk with Gaynor Howells. The headlines. President Yeltsin is making another attempt to persuade the Russian parliament to endorse his choice of Sergei Kiryenko as prime minister. A senior American official on a visit to Afghanistan says the Taliban militia has agreed to halt any new attacks against its northern opponents. A judge in South Africa has blocked an attempt by President Mandela to investigate why the country's top rugby teams are all white. And the opposition, Social Democrats in Germany, are choosing their candidate to challenge Helmut Kohl for the chancellorship. Among our other reports, we'll be setting the scene for the Middle East tour by the British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And President Clinton today addresses Congress in Chile as speculation continues over whether the former dictator Augusto Pinochet will attend. The acting Prime Minister of Russia, Sergei Kiryenko, has been appealing directly to deputies in the lower house of parliament to approve his permanent appointment to the post. President Yeltsin has warned he'll dissolve parliament if it doesn't endorse Mr. Kiryenko. His appointment has already been blocked once, with the large communist group of deputies leading the opposition. Paul Anderson reports from Moscow.
Mr. Kiryenko spoke for nearly 30 minutes, reeling off facts and figures on Russia's economy with fluency and confidence. It wasn't a charismatic performance. Mr. Kiryenko is placing his trust in his reputation as a competent technocrat. Instead, he appealed to deputies by addressing the issues which most concern them. He promised rapid action to pay pensions on time, to protect key sectors like the coal industry and agriculture, and to make up the funding shortfall to the military. Mr. Kiryenko also promised a new era of cooperation between the government and parliament, something which deputies have complained was conspicuously absent under the sacked Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. But the cards are stacked against President Yeltsin's protege. He's been lobbying opponents intensively in the past week and appears to have failed to reverse their hostility towards his appointment. Communists and their allies have again promised to vote against him. They'll be joined by a sizable bloc of liberal deputies, who say they're yet to be convinced that Mr. Kiryenko has sufficient experience to handle Russia's enormous economic problems. In an earlier pre-recorded radio address, President Yeltsin said that although the dismissal of the government was a rare event, Russia's stability was not under threat, and the acting government was functioning normally. He has repeatedly warned deputies that if they reject his candidate a third time, he will dissolve parliament and order new elections. That's an option the president is gambling that deputies may not want to risk.
Paul Anderson reporting. And we've just heard that the Duma has rejected Mr. Kiryenko for a second time. The vote was 215 for the acting prime minister and 271 against. President Yeltsin is due to begin a visit to Japan later today to hold informal talks with the Japanese Prime Minister Ryotaro Hashimoto. Correspondents say their discussions are likely to focus mainly on the dispute between the two countries over the sovereignty of the South Kuril Islands. The dispute has prevented them signing a peace treaty that would formally end hostilities begun during the Second World War. President Yeltsin is also expected to try to encourage Japanese investment in Russia. Romania, one of the 10 Central and Eastern European countries expecting to join the European Union, has a new government. The Prime Minister, Radu Vasile, who formally takes office today, has promised to speed up the pace of wide-ranging reforms. He wants Romania, one of the poorest countries in the region, to prepare itself to join the main institutions of the West. William Horsley, who's in the capital, Bucharest, examines the challenges facing the new government.
Romania, a country of more than 20 million people bordering the Black Sea at the crossroads of East and West, is still a long way behind others, like its neighbour Hungary, in throwing off the shadow of its communist past. But the new Prime Minister, Radu Vasile, has promised to speed up the pace of change to make Romania a fully-fledged democracy and market economy. His plans for privatizing the nation's telecommunications and other sectors within this year may give some Western European firms new business opportunities. The government also promises to pass new laws to show Romania's progress in areas ranging from open markets to blocking former communist power brokers from holding public office. It's far from certain that Mr. Vasile, a Christian Democrat, can see through his pledges at the head of a centrist coalition not very different from the one that collapsed late last month. Still, it's clear, politically and economically, Romania is on the move, throwing off the now hated remnants of its communist past. The nation's leaders, from President Emil Constantinescu down, share a concern that the European Union and NATO are not taking Romania's requests for membership as seriously as its strategic position and economic potential demand.
William Horsley in Romania. The United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, who's on a visit to Afghanistan, has been meeting senior Taliban officials in Kabul. He's the most senior American official to visit the country for more than 20 years. Before the talks, Mr. Richardson told reporters that he'd raise the issue of women's rights. He also said he hoped to get a ceasefire in Afghanistan and said that the country deserved more attention from the international community. From the capital, Kabul, here's William Reeve.
Bill Richardson's brief visit was arranged to support the current peace initiative of the United Nations Special Envoy to Afghanistan, Lakhdar Brahimi. And speaking at the end of his talks with the second most senior Taliban leader, Mullah Mohammad Rabbani, Mr. Richardson said good progress has been made. He said the Taliban have now agreed to hold face-to-face talks with the Northern Opposition Alliance in Islamabad within the next 10 days. Both sides have, however, already agreed with Mr. Brahimi to go ahead with these talks, which are preliminary discussions about how full peace negotiations might take place. But Mr. Richardson said the Taliban have also agreed there will be no major offensive until these preliminary talks are held. He says that as a gesture of goodwill, the Taliban have agreed to release a significant number of prisoners of war very shortly. Mr. Richardson said female doctors will now be allowed to work, but many already do. He said he also discussed issues concerning narcotic drugs and the curbing of terrorism. During his visit, Mr. Richardson visited the American Embassy in Kabul, which has remained empty for many years. Here, he laid a wreath on the grave of Adolf Dubs, the last American ambassador to Afghanistan, who was murdered in a Kabul hotel in 1979.
William Reeve in Kabul. Thai military officials have carried out a post-mortem on the body believed to be that of the former Khmer Rouge leader Pol Pot, who was responsible for the death of more than a million Cambodians. They say the initial examination showed the cause of death to be a heart attack. But as Enver Solomon reports from Bangkok, the Thai government still remains unconvinced.
The post-mortem has done nothing more than confirm that the body is definitely that of the former Khmer Rouge leader. Doubts still remain over the cause of Pol Pot's death, although the military officials who examined the body say that Pol Pot did die of a heart attack. They didn't carry out a full medical autopsy and acknowledge that their assessment isn't necessarily correct. The Cambodian government has serious doubts. It wants a proper examination carried out by qualified doctors. The government suspects that the Khmer Rouge have a hidden agenda. There's no doubt that the death of Pol Pot is extremely convenient for the guerrilla movement. Fragmented after a wave of defections, the guerrillas are keen to strike a deal that would allow them to have some kind of political future. The Cambodian government is insisting that the remaining leaders of the Khmer Rouge, especially their brutal military commander, Thao Mok, must be brought to justice. The United Nations has also said they should be put on trial. It wants the world to remember that Pol Pot was not the only leader of the Khmer Rouge. But capturing Thao Mok and his comrades won't be easy. They remain deep in the northern Cambodian jungle, surrounded by landmines and determined to carry on with their struggle.
Enver Solomon. You're listening to News Desk in the BBC World Service. A South African judge has blocked an attempt by President Nelson Mandela to investigate alleged racism in the running of one of the country's most popular sports, rugby union. A presidential commission of inquiry was ordered last year into the sport's controlling body, SAFU, which has been criticised for fielding all-white teams. The rugby authorities opposed the inquiry, but our Southern Africa correspondent Jeremy Vine reports from Pretoria that in spite of this triumph, problems for the sport still lie ahead.
The man at the helm of South African rugby was beaming broadly after his victory, behaving with his customary genial aggression towards reporters and hailing a triumph for justice. Louis Late brought the case after Nelson Mandela decided to hold an inquiry into why the top level of South African rugby remains almost totally white. Dr. Late's victory today means the inquiry cannot proceed, although the government may well appeal. It does not mean he is safe in his job, though. Quite the opposite. Disgusted by Dr. Late's intrusion, intransigence. By the way, rugby did not capitalize on multiracial support after South Africa's World Cup win 3 years ago. And by the lack of development opportunities for promising black players. The National Sports Council here has given Louis Leight until May the 7th to resign, and it's thought he will. South Africans were reminded of rugby's outstanding problems with an incident involving Tox van der Linde, a Springboks player, who was yesterday fined $1,800 for calling a black woman a Kaffir in a New Zealand bar on Wednesday. She pronounced herself distraught, and the player is to face a disciplinary hearing.
Jeremy Vine. The Rwandan government says the security forces have killed 70 Hutu rebels in a raid in the central region of Gitarama. A statement said civilians fought alongside troops after the raid began on Wednesday. Earlier, the defense minister, Paul Kagame, said the current security problems could be brought under control. The main opposition party in Germany, the Social Democrats, the SPD, has begun a conference in Leipzig to launch its campaign for September's general election. The conference is expected to endorse Gerhard Schröder as the party's candidate to challenge Helmut Kohl for the chancellorship. Chancellor Kohl is trailing in opinion polls at present, but as Janet Barry reports from the conference, the SPD is taking nothing for granted.
This one-day conference is a carefully stage-managed event designed to convince German voters the SPD is ready for power after 16 years in opposition. The Social Democrat challenger to Helmut Kohl, Gerhard Schröder, made a triumphant entrance and in his speech said Chancellor Kohl's time in office was over. He stressed the SPD's pledge to reduce unemployment and called on delegates to support action over ideology. Mr. Schröder won his party's nomination to challenge Chancellor Kohl after he secured a resounding victory in elections in his home state of Lower Saxony last month. He's presented himself as a dynamic moderniser who wants to make the SPD more friendly to business, but he has hard work ahead in uniting the party. Observers here have said this Leipzig conference has been tightly timetabled to avoid divisive debates. Opinion polls since Mr. Schröder's nomination as the SPD candidate for the chancellorship have shown the party as much as 12 percentage points ahead of Helmut Kohl's Christian Democrats. But the SPD leadership is stressing it can't afford complacency. Chancellor Kohl is a shrewd political fighter who has emerged victorious after poor poll showings in the past.
Janet Barry in Leipzig. The leader of the largest party in Northern Ireland, David Trimble of the Ulster Unionists, is today undertaking a final round of intense lobbying to win support for the Northern Ireland peace deal ahead of a crucial party meeting on Saturday. Mr. Trimble, who faces strong opposition from within his own party and from other Protestant groups to the agreement, is expected to speak to the British Prime Minister Tony Blair before he sets off for his trip to the Middle East. Mr. Blair, in his role as the current chairman of the European Union, begins his tour in Egypt. His visit comes after the row between Israel and Britain over the recent trip by Britain's Foreign Secretary Robin Cook to a controversial Jewish settlement in East Jerusalem. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Barnaby Mason.
Tony Blair comes to the Middle East a bare week after helping to broker a peace agreement in Northern Ireland. His spokesman said he'd had letters of congratulation from Middle East leaders, but conceded there weren't too many direct parallels between the two conflicts. All the same, the lesson of the Irish example was that you must never stop talking or trying. Mr. Blair is emphasising the European dimension of his tour, undertaken as chairman of the EU. He hopes to give a new impetus to the deadlocked Middle East peace process, but is discounting any idea of a breakthrough. That's just as well. There's been a lot of talk about boosting the part played by the European Union, but little clear idea of how it can move beyond the role of financial backer of the peace process to become a political player. The Arabs see the Europeans as more sympathetic to them, and therefore a counterweight to the Clinton administration, perceived as pro-Israeli. However, one of Mr. Blair's aims this time is to mend some fences with the Israeli government. Last month there was a row over the visit by the British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook to the site of a controversial Jewish settlement in occupied East Jerusalem. Mr. Blair won't be going to East Jerusalem at all, though his spokesman maintained that was only to allow him to spend more time in Gaza. The spokesman said the tour was balanced between Arabs and Israelis.
Barnaby Mason reporting from Cairo. It's 10:14 GMT, a reminder of the main headline again. President Yeltsin is making another attempt to persuade the Russian parliament to endorse his choice of Sergei Kiryenko as prime minister. And still to come in the programme, with trouble facing one of the big internet companies, we have a report on signs of progress between Europe and the United States on how the worldwide computer service should be governed in future. Well, the Russian lower house of parliament, the Duma, has just rejected President Yeltsin's nominee for prime minister, Sergei Kiryenko, and the vote was 115 for Mr. Kiryenko and 271 against. His appointment has already been blocked once, with a large communist group of deputies leading the opposition. Our Moscow correspondent, Alan Little, reports.
271 deputies voted against Mr. Kiryenko, 115 voted for. That's an even greater defeat than he suffered a week ago. Mr. Kiryenko looked unruffled, smiled, stood and walked away without comment. In his spirited address to Parliament, Mr. Kiryenko tried to appear ready to meet the deputies' concerns, saying he would, as Prime Minister, address their anxieties about the state of Russia's industrial sector and its state-owned enterprises. But at the same time, he stressed that there would be no change of economic policy. He has failed to win the backing of the leaders of the largest bloc, the communists. Their leader, Gennady Zyuganov, again accused President Yeltsin of acting unconstitutionally in re-nominating Mr. Kiryenko after Parliament had voted against him last week. A few minutes before the vote, Mr. Yeltsin said he would, if his candidate were rejected, immediately re-nominate the same man for a third and final time. If the Duma rejects him again, the country is in for months of political infighting, and Russia will be without a government throughout the long summer. It is a huge setback for President Yeltsin, who wants his reform program to deliver an economic recovery before the next presidential elections in 2000. But he says he will go ahead with a planned visit to Japan later today, insisting that the country is not in political crisis. In his absence, Russia will be without a leader.
Alan Little. President Clinton is due to address the Chilean Congress in Valparaiso today, but there's controversy about whether the former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet will attend. General Pinochet took up a seat in the Senate for life when he stepped down as head of the army last month, and so he has a right to be there, despite protests by those who opposed his regime in the 1970s and 80s. Here's our South America correspondent, Richard Collings.
Last-minute preparations are still underway to ensure President Clinton is able to address politicians in both houses of parliament. General Pinochet took up his seat in the upper house, the Senate, last month. Critics of his former military regime say having the two men in the same room at the same time must be avoided at all costs. They're planning demonstrations outside the parliament building. Left-wing groups claim Mr. Clinton's presence will be seen as an endorsement of General Pinochet, who's made it clear he wants to be remembered as a Democrat rather than as a dictator. There have been suggestions that the general might miss the event altogether because of health problems, but no confirmation is expected until just before President Clinton speaks. When he addresses Parliament, Mr. Clinton will praise Chile's peaceful transition to democracy. The country's now ruled by a multi-party coalition, which recently failed to agree on whether to strip General Pinochet of his self-assigned seat in the Senate. The former head of the army is currently facing six separate investigations into his past human rights record. During the 17 years he was in power, over 3,000 people went missing.
Richard Collings in the Chilean capital, Santiago. Thousands of rural workers in Brazil are beginning a day of nationwide protests to mark the second anniversary of the killing by police of 19 peasant activists. About 150 officers are alleged to have taken part in the massacre, but so far none has been brought to trial. The protesters, members of the Landless People's Movement, known as MST, are also demanding that unproductive farms be given to landless families. Here's our Brazil correspondent, Stephen Sveach.
The massacre of 19 landless people in the northern state of Pará in 1996 marked a watershed in the history of the Brazilian countryside, bringing the issue of agrarian reform into the centre of political debate. The circumstances of the killings caused outrage around the world. The peasants had blocked a road in order to demand the expropriation of a local farm, and when they came into conflict with a group of policemen, the police opened fire. As a way of commemorating that event, thousands of MST members, wearing the movement's red baseball caps and T-shirts, are due to converge on state capitals around Brazil, where they will stage protests in front of government buildings. Part of their anger will be directed against the judicial system for its slowness in processing the cases of the policemen who are due to stand trial for the crime. But the main aim of the protest is to demand faster redistribution of unproductive farms owned by big landowners.
Stephen Sveach in Sao Paulo. The Federal Aviation Authority in the United States has proposed more air safety recommendations as a result of the crash of a Boeing 747 jumbo jet off Long Island in 1996, in which 230 people died. The authority has called for changes in the electrical systems of the smaller Boeing 737 aircraft, following similar recommendations for the 747. No specific cause for the 1996 crash has ever been identified, but safety experts suspect it was connected to a fault in wiring in a fuel tank monitoring system. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC's World Service. It's now 10:20 GMT. The Indonesian government and international bank creditors meeting in New York say they've agreed a framework for a deal on the rescheduling of about $80 billion worth of Indonesian private sector debt. A joint statement issued after 2 days of talks said that subcommittees had been formed to deal with the details of a deal before a full meeting next month. The International Monetary Fund has put forward proposals aimed at helping avoid crises of the kind which hit Mexico 3 years ago and Southeast Asia last year. The plans, presented at a meeting of finance ministers in Washington, range from involving the private sector in helping to resolve problems to raising standards of financial management. And our economics correspondent, James Morgan, reports from Washington that the fund has even looked to the business of sport for inspiration.
These wide-ranging proposals came from a meeting of the fund's governing board, which brings together more than 20 finance ministers from around the world. One radical idea is that the IMF should be more forthright with governments which are making mistakes. The fund's managing director, Michel Camdessou, said the finance ministers had borrowed an idea from football. There would first of all be a yellow card.
One of the aspects of it would be, for instance, when I send a letter to a prime minister or to a minister of finance to tell him that he must respond to my letter, possibly within a short delay, and so allowing me to share his response to the executive board.
Then there would be a red card, which would be a public warning. That presents some problems, for it could trigger just the kind of crisis the IMF would hope to avoid. But Mr. Camdessou said that fear wouldn't inhibit him, because the origin of the crisis would be the misgovernment of the country concerned and not his public criticism. But he hoped he would never have to do it. Publicity and transparency are key elements of the plan. The fund is to tell its members that they should release more financial information to the news media. But the finance ministers didn't accept the views of many developing countries that banks which made unwise loans should be made to suffer large losses as a matter of policy.
James Morgan in Washington. More business news now with Yusuf Anani.
First, a look at the markets. In Japan, the Nikkei closed at 15,703, down 179. London's FTSE index of 100 shares is currently at 5,939, down 62.9. Currencies, and the pound is buying $1.69, and the dollar is at 1 mark 80 and 131 yen. A Malaysian company has announced it's to buy a 40% stake of loss-making British company Laura Ashley. The firm became famous with women's fashion and home furnishings, but has since fallen out of favour with consumers. Its North American operation has been particularly hard hit. The firm lost more than £25 million in its last year's trading. The president of the American internet company Netscape, James Barksdale, was paid $1 in salary in 1997, compared to $100,000 the year before. Netscape, which makes software which allows access to the internet, reported its first loss in the 3 months to January and cut 400 jobs. Netscape is fighting a court battle with the giant Microsoft over access to the new PC market.
Yusuf Anani. The European Commission has said its differences with the United States over who'll govern the internet computer network are moving towards a resolution. Some analysts had been predicting what they called an internet war after the United States proposed giving its courts jurisdiction over disputes. But at the annual Worldwide Web conference in Australia, the EC's Information Market Policies Director, Frans de Bruin, has given a more upbeat assessment. Our internet correspondent, Chris Nuttall, is attending the conference in the city of Brisbane.
The United States and Europe have been at odds over who should regulate the internet in the future. The Clinton administration published a green paper in February suggesting trademark issues and other disputes to do with the internet should be subject to U.S. jurisdiction. It also said American companies could control the issuing of new names for internet sites. The European Commission wants international bodies and companies to be involved instead. Frans de Bruin, the EC Director of Information Market Policies, said high-level talks had resulted in both sides now moving in the right direction, and reasonable solutions could be reached by a deadline at the end of September. He said there were strong economic reasons for compromise on the issues.
Everybody is convinced that there's large potential in these networks, in internet, particularly when electronic commerce starts to take off, potential for new activities, and that of course means new jobs, which is very important for Europe. I think that is the firm understanding and the firm belief of everybody, and there is a basic will, in my view, to collaborate and work together, although there are always differences in how exactly to implement things.
Mr. de Bruin added that the United States was supportive towards the European idea of a global internet charter, which he said would provide a coherent framework for policies, but was not an attempt by Europe to regulate the internet.
Chris Nuttall reporting. The new county cricket season opens in England today, weather permitting, and defeats recently in the Test and One Day series in the Caribbean underline the problems in the English game, and the debate continues over how to improve standards. In the meantime, overseas players have dominated the build-up to the county season. Mike Costello reports.
Players past and present appear convinced that splitting the county championship into two divisions would add a competitive edge to benefit the Test side in the long term. But for now, the diehards running the county clubs are holding sway and the old format survives. Warwickshire have been installed as favourites to take the championship, largely because of the return of Brian Lara. The West Indies captain is back at Edgbaston after a four-year absence. Last time he scored more than 2,000 runs and inspired Warwickshire to a unique treble of trophies. This time he's arrived in England with just a day to spare, and only after his West Indies teammate Phil Simmons gave up his seat on a flight from the Caribbean. Simmons is playing for Leicestershire and they don't have a game this weekend. Lara is jaded after the series against England, but he's keen to get going again.
Might be tired, yes, but I think the success that West Indies team had over the last 3 or 4 months against England, I think it's enough for me to come here and try to improve on that performance, or maybe do as well as we did in 1994 for Warwickshire. It's not saying I'm tired, but I'm quite happy with how things have gone so far, and I'm looking forward to this season.
Lara and Warwickshire start against Durham. On his last stint here, Lara scored a world record 501 against them. Mike Atherton opens the batting for Lancashire in their game against Sussex, despite being offered a rest after his Caribbean tour. And Matthew Maynard is at the helm at Glamorgan once again, as they attempt to become only the third side in 22 years to retain the county championship.
Mike Costello reporting. To end News Desk, here are the main points again. The lower house of the Russian parliament has rejected for a second time President Yeltsin's choice of Sergei Kiryenko as prime minister. The margin of defeat was much greater than the first vote a week ago. Mr. Yeltsin has immediately renominated Mr. Kiryenko. The United States ambassador to the United Nations, Bill Richardson, who's visiting Afghanistan, says the Taliban movement has agreed to stop any new offensive against its northern opponents. He also said the Taliban had agreed to hold peace talks. A South African judge has blocked an attempt by President Mandela to investigate alleged racism in the running of the country's most popular sport, rugby football. The rugby authorities say the judge's verdict was a victory for democracy. And the opposition, Social Democrats in Germany, are meeting to launch their campaign for the general election later this year. Delegates are expected to endorse Gerhard Schröder as the party's candidate to challenge Chancellor Helmut Kohl. And there we end News Desk.